decided on the next best thing. Jack put the word out, and all former raiders on the island got together that afternoon before I was to leave. We had to meet at the NCO club, so I plucked off my insignia. The Army's fraternization rules dealt not only with the opposite sex, but also between officers and enlisted. In other words, it was okay for an EM to die in your arms, but most unbecoming for you to drink with one in his club. It was the first time we'd partied together outside the raider camp. We pushed tables together and covered their tops end to end with the only thing going, whiskey and coke. So many faces were missing, but we still had a merry time, fueled by the booze, the war stories, and our love and respect for each other, until some sergeant from one of the battalions recognized my face. "Hey, you're a lieutenant! Hackworth, from the Raiders! What are you doing in our club?" The sergeant started to heavy me, but then my boys stood up, and by the end of the brawl, about the only thing left of the NCO club was the concrete floor and roof. The Raiders may have been low on numbers, and it was certainly not our most professional fight, but there was no doubt at all that we'd won. The following morning, hungover and with a bashed-up face, I packed my bags. The boys saw me off at the coastal steamer that would take me to Busan, then Sasebo, Japan, and then home. And as I looked at all the black eyes and split lips around me, I knew the NCO club incident was the only fitting end for the Raiders. We'd been born in battle, and that's how we finished up, too. 8. They don't have cobwebs in Korea. We must get down to the essentials, make clear the real difficulties, and expunge the bunk, complications, and ponderosities. We must concentrate on registering in men's minds certain vital considerations, instead of a mass of less important details. General George Catlett Marshall, Assistant Commandant, Fort Benning, Georgia, 1927 through 32. The style of leadership I developed with the Raiders would stay with me for the rest of my Army career. I had more balls than brains. I was a reckless buccaneer on one hand, a nimble high-wire artist on the other, always teetering on the thin edge of regulations. Many times I'd be right on the verge of falling. Sometimes I'd even take a plunge. But there was always someone, an Eggleston, a Gilchrist, an Evans, a Sloan, to help me regain my balance, or hold the net. And I would need him, whoever he was. Even my short stay at Sasebo did not bode well for me as a stateside officer. Monkey see, monkey do. With the help of a big book on the Army officer and a few wolfhound buddies billeted in my bachelor officer's quarters, BOQ, I began my conversion from combat warrior to garrison lieutenant. It was not going to be easy. I suddenly found myself in a most competitive, utterly foreign Army world, where the object was not to win battles against an enemy, but to shine among your peers, even as every one of you conformed to the same rigid code of behavior. Most of my contemporaries were very smart and system savvy. They knew just what to say, just how to say it, and whom to say it to. I didn't, so I had little choice but to use the same tactics I had since I'd been commissioned. Watch, listen, and learn, but for Christ's sake, keep your mouth shut. It was the only way I'd survive. The only person in Sasebo who did not make me painfully aware of my lack of education was a girl named Katie who worked for the Red Cross. Katie, from Iowa, was the nicest girl I'd ever met. She had dark hair and flashing blue eyes, and we fell madly in love. We became so involved, in fact, that Katie went to a senior Army friend to see if I could be assigned to the Sasebo base. D.A. had assigned me to Fort Benning for the infantry company officer's course, but I was so lovesick, I was ready to give it all up and inventory sheets for the rest of my life just to walk in Katie's shadow. But it was not to be. The Army, my stern, unyielding father, said no way. Katie and I were heartbroken. Our tragedy left Romeo and Juliet's for dead. The night before I shipped out, we went to a local officer's club for a last special evening. The club was a huge place, multi-tiered with dining tables on each level, all overlooking a dance floor, bar, and more tables on the ground floor. Both in uniform, because that was the rule, and wearing brave smiles, Katie and I sat by the railing on the second tier and made plans for our future over a candlelit dinner and a couple of bottles of wine. The perfect evening might have gone on forever, but we were interrupted by some Navy John Paul Jones who'd known Katie before. She asked him nicely to leave. He did, but soon started sending his buddies over, one by one, to ask her to dance. The nonstop harassment started taking its toll. My blood was boiling. But Katie reminded me that discretion was the better part of valor, and we decided we'd just leave. Unfortunately, John Paul Jones decided to block our way, so I asked him to move. He told me to get fucked. I told him to move, and before he had a chance to say, "I have not yet begun to fight," I fired a torpedo that sank his wise ass to the bottom of the dance floor. He took the railing with him, and a club-wide fight ensued, with the Navy crowd below starting to charge the stairs only to be ambushed by Army guys at the bar, led by Neck Aspera Tarrant, no fear on earth, wolfhounds, who'd watched the whole thing build up. I grabbed Katie and the wine, and we retreated to better defensive ground, the third floor. The gladiators below, who'd already forgotten who started the fight, were duking it out most enthusiastically, so we hung around, drinking wine and enjoying the show until a wail of MP sirens told us it was time to bug. Katie led me down the back steps to her chauffeur-driven Red Cross sedan, with me hiding on the floor under a blanket and Katie's little feet plumped down on my back. We drove out just as the police threw a cordon around the club to prevent any participants from leaving. It had been a fine evening after all, and we spent the rest of the night giggling about sinking Navy in the brig. The next morning, Katie came down to the pier and waited on the dock while tugboats pushed our long gray transport ship into the channel. As the ship pulled away, we waved and shouted last-minute I love yous, me pushing my way back toward the stern of the crowded ship, calling at the top of my lungs, she walking down the dock to the end of the pier, tears streaming down her cheeks. I stood on the fantail as we sailed away, until Katie got so small that all I could see was the waving of her long red scarf. I never saw her again. And then we were home. The Golden Gate Bridge rose out of the fog. It brought back memories. I'd come this way before. The first time had been in early 1946 when I returned from my tour with the Merchant Marine. I'd been 14 when I joined that outfit, disgusted that World War II had ended without my assistance and on the run from juvenile authorities. The judge had given me one last chance. After I'd run away from one foster home in Lancaster, California, it had been more like a slave labor camp for children, he'd sent me to another home in Palmdale where a gentle lady named Mrs. Ordway waited for her husband to come home from the war. I'd liked that place, and I'd liked Mrs. Ordway, and I might have stayed there forever but for my terrible temper and one of the other kids, a bully named Milton, who rode me one step too far. I knew it'd be the end of the road when Mrs. Ordway found out I'd cleaned his clock. I'd be on to Whittier, Preston, and San Quentin in that order. So I ran away from Palmdale, too, and started hitching my way back to Los Angeles. What I'd do when I got there, I didn't know. I figured I'd probably try to join the Marine Corps or the Army again, but at least I was on the road. I'd been waiting at a gas station for another ride when a Dodge station wagon pulled up, a 1942 model in mint condition. It was a most incredible sight in 1945. The Dodge was probably one of the last cars off the line before they stopped making them in 42 as part of the war effort. While the attendant was busy filling it up, I'd moseyed over to the driver and tapped him on the shoulder. "Hey, mister, are you going to L.A.?" I asked. The guy turned, and my heart skipped a beat. He was a cop in plain clothes. "Yes, I am, boy. Hop in." It had been too late to run away, and in the desert of Southern California there weren't too many places to run away. So I got into the car, looking around for radios and whatever else cops keep in their vehicles. I didn't see anything, but I still expected the guy to put me under arrest any second. The scariest part was that I was convinced he knew me and was just biding his time. I knew him. I'd recognized his face. We'd headed toward L.A. When we stopped for lunch, it became pretty apparent I didn't have 10 cents in my pocket, so he bought me a sandwich and a Coke. We started to talk. He really was a nice guy, and suddenly I realized that he wasn't a cop, but the guy who always played the cop, or the priest, in the movies. Straight from one of my favorite war films, The Fighting 69th, it was Pat O'Brien, and one of the great thrills of my life. I told him I was going to visit my grandmother in Ocean Park, but not much more. I couldn't see Pat O'Brien wanting to be a real-life accessory to my escape. And when we hit L.A., he insisted on driving me home. I hadn't counted on that. The fact was, I couldn't go home, because Graham would haul me right back to the judge if I stepped in her door. He started asking me about my address when we got to Santa Monica. I suggested he drop me off right there. "You said you live in Ocean Park," he said. "How are you going to get home?" I told him I'd take the bus. "Thought you didn't have any money." "I'll walk." He stopped the car and put his hand on my shoulder. "How old are you?"
14, sir."
"Let me tell you something, kid. I know you're on the lam. You don't have any money, and every time a police car's gone by all day, you've as good as slid under the seat." I started to explain, but he stopped me. He reached into his wallet and pulled out a bill. And as I sat there thinking Pat O'Brien was going to give me a dollar and the bus only cost a nickel, he handed me a 20.
"Keep it, kid. You'll need it," he said.
I'd gone right over to Al Hewitt's, but his mother knew I was hot, so she wouldn't let me stay. With my newly acquired 20 bucks, I'd checked into a boarding house for a week, which left me $4 and 7 days to decide my future. It had been Al's idea to join the Merchant Marine. He told me our schoolmate, Kenny Carpenter, had just come back from somewhere out in the Pacific, that he was a big war hero, had lots of money, and all the girls in town were throwing themselves at him. I liked the sound of that, and if Kenny's reception on the home front weren't compelling enough reason, about the same time my brother Roy, who was 17, joined the Navy, and my cousins, John and Donald Hackworth, came home war heroes from the South Pacific. So the Merchant Marine it would be, except for the problem of my age. Al had been all right. He was a couple of years older. But I needed to be 16, and even then, because I was still a minor, the permission of my father. It had been a tall order for a kid, to age 2 years overnight, to resurrect a father who'd been dead for 13. Still, where there's a will, there's a way. We just went down to the beach and found a suitably aged wino to whom we gave a dollar, with the promise of another, to come with us to a notary public, call himself my father, and give permission for his son, born 11 November 1928, to join the Merchant Marine. Within a few hours, one wino had a windfall, and Al and I were on San Pedro, joining the Seamen's Union and being assigned berths on a ship that was leaving at noon the following day. I stowed my gear and stayed on board while Al went home to say goodbye to his parents. The next morning, no sign of Al. At 12 o'clock, just as we were pulling away, I saw him running down the dock. "We're going to leave without you, Al. Hurry," I called from the deck. "Can't go," he yelled back. "Why not? Mother won't let me." "So long, Al." The name of the merchant ship was the SS Marine Lynx. Its role to shuttle personnel and supplies between Guam, Saipan, and Aweetok and Tinian. My job had been that of an apprentice seaman, 8-hour days spent shifting ballast and chipping, priming, and painting anything on board that didn't move. I had no area of responsibility. The ship didn't depend on me in any way, so I had plenty of time to look around, and by the time we got to the islands, I pretty well understood how things worked. Like, if I took care of the cook with an extra can of paint when he needed one, he'd take care of me with huge sandwiches and other goodies, as requested day or night. A perfect arrangement, given a kid of 14's bottomless pit for a stomach. I'd also figured out that because the Marine Lynx was such a huge ship, C-4 class, it wouldn't be tough for a guy to disappear himself for a day or two at a time, so whenever we were in port at Guam, I'd go AWOL at first light. I'd wrap my clothes in a plastic bag and throw them into the ocean.
Then I'd dive in, swim the mile or so to shore, get dressed, and find myself a marine outfit to tag along with on patrol. I'd stay with them the rest of the day, crawling through knocked-out Japanese tanks and bunkers and picking up rusting weapons and other souvenirs in the jungle. On more than one occasion, I'd found myself hugging the ground, too. It was late 1945, and the Japanese left on Guam were the ones who, fanatically refusing to accept that the war was over, were determined to fight it out on their own. When the patrols came in at night, I'd catch a landing craft infantry, LCI, back to my ship. No one ever checked up. You needed permission to go ashore, but not to come back on board. But the best nights were the couple when I missed the LCI. I had little choice then but to follow the Marines back to their village and spend the night with them, too, listening to war stories and watching them get drunk. Some of the Marine guys kind of adopted me, as had members of the Army regiment that was billeted in Ocean Park when I was a kid. It was really a dream come true. Although I'd been an eager Army mascot at home, complete with little uniform, WW1 campaign hat and blue braid, and starving to learn anything the GIs would teach me, secretly, I'd always wanted to be a Marine. One reason was Graham had always said my birthday was 10 November, Marine Day. The other was because there were lots of Marines in Santa Monica during the war, and they'd had the snazziest uniforms and the shiniest shoes of all the services. And I knew shoes because I'd made a small fortune shining them for the Army guys up the road. All in all, the Merchant Marine Tour had been just a great, great adventure, which ended only when I cut my foot badly on some coral during one of my forays. The wound became infected, and I was sent home by hospital ship in March 1946. To my great surprise, the welcome our vessel received in San Francisco 7 months after the war had ended was probably as enthusiastic as on VJ Day itself. Banners and signs dotted the shoreline, thanking us and proclaiming job well done. Boats with bands jammed the harbor, and spilling across the horizon were what seemed like millions of beautiful, waving girls. It was a great warrior's homecoming, and amidst all the excitement, I was transferred to the Marine Hospital, where I spent 3 weeks recovering from my wound. And if anyone asked how I got it, and didn't ask too quickly, I'd tell them a little story about those Japs on Guam. But it was not 1946 anymore. It was 1952, and though the Golden Gate appeared on cue, then and there the similarity ended. Before we even docked, I knew that no one would be asking me this time how I got wounded, or even how went the war. The shoreline was empty, save for a few curious onlookers. The harbor was ours alone, other than the pilot boat with its grim-faced officials who came on board to facilitate our unloading. There were no bands, no banners, no signs, no girls. There was nothing, really, at all. My arrival in Santa Monica was a bit more auspicious. My friend Irwin Erky Cheldon's father, who'd been really good to my grandmother and me during a lot of lean times, organized a parade through the streets of my hometown, and a lot of people came out to cheer for their bad boy who'd made good. I always loved parades, military ones especially. We had them all the time in Trieste, from a simple pass-and-review almost every night at retreat to a humdinger once or twice a month for some visiting VIP. It wasn't just the ceremony I loved, or the shivers that went up my spine every time the martial music began to play. It was being part of the parade itself. I was so proud to be a cog in that finely tuned machine. I loved the discipline. The relentless repetition, basic drills reinforced again and again, that conditioned a soldier to react to orders not only on the parade field, but on the battlefield as well. When we'd practiced, two guys would hold a string along a whole rank of men to make sure we were perfectly lined up. We'd stand at attention until someone dropped. Then we'd ignore him and stand there, unflinching, even longer. When we'd marched, every heel hit the ground at the exact same time. All arms swung in perfect unison. No man's white-gloved hand moved an inch farther back or forth than any other trooper's in the column. The precision was most incredible. Right shoulder, arms. Right turn, march. would come the order, and 1,200 men in Class A uniforms in perfect synchrony would pass in review, one company after another, each fluidly and simultaneously executing mass turns and staring straight ahead as if it were the most natural thing in the world. In the I&R, I'd usually been guide-on-bearer for Captain Eggleston's regimental HQ company, so for me there was always the added thrill of high-stepping it with the man in the front of the unit. But it was a lot easier, I decided, being custodian of the company guide-on in a trust parade than being the complete focus of a parade in your own hometown. I didn't mind the fact that there was no military precision among the flag wavers lining the streets. It's just that I had nothing to do, except smile and wave and be pretty embarrassed about the whole thing. Graham beamed. I'm sure the only parades old Ida Stedman Hackworth ever thought she'd share with me were those forced marches she'd take me on between our house and Juvenile Hall. The path had been well beaten through misdemeanors accrued between the ages of 7 and 14. What have I done, she'd moan, to deserve such a terrible child? Roy was there, my somber, studious older brother. I used to tell people the reason we were so different was that our mother's maiden name was Kennefic, which translated from Gaelic as both great warrior and great scholar. On the playground, I'd duke it out with anyone who gave Roy a hard time, but in our own games, it had been every man for himself. Once we were playing war with dirt clods and BB guns in an empty lot down the street from our house. I'd deployed my troops throughout the battle area and posted myself so that no one could outflank us by slipping around the front of Jerry's liquor store, which was against the rules anyway. I'd sat there biding my time and admiring the brand new Daisy single-shot BB gun I'd wanted all my life and had just gotten for Christmas, when who should suddenly appear around the off-limits area but my brother, one of the aggressor soldiers. "Halt," I'd called. "Put up your hands. You can't go any farther. You're a prisoner of war, and I'm taking you in." Roy wouldn't surrender, so I shot him. At the parade, now 10 years later, I noticed he still carried the scar uncomfortably close to his eye. My BB gun, which had been unceremoniously broken over my back by Uncle Frank, Graham's other brother, was probably still under the house where Frank had thrown it, warning me never, ever to go down there to get it. Frank had been dead for almost 5 years now. I'd gotten the news in Italy, the very morning the Jugs tried to take Trieste. Though I'd long gotten over the tears, time had done nothing for the fears. Uncle Frank could rest easy in his grave, because the BB gun would stay right where it was. The parade passed by all the old haunts. The area around Jerry's liquor store was now built up. In my childhood, it had stood vulnerably between two vacant lots and had been too much to resist. My gang, Harry Brown, Sidney Dworkin, R. Lee Kerrigan, Richard Johnson, and I used to knock it off at least twice a month. We'd used an old abandoned touring bus in a junkyard as our HQ, and every raid was planned, written out, rehearsed, and executed with strict military precision. Pint-sized commandos. "Okay, Sidney, you're the lookout. Richard, go by this window with a rock. When you throw it in, I want you, R. Lee. You'll be across the street. You start bashing on the lid of that garbage can. That'll cover the noise. Harry, you jump in the window and throw the loot out. We'll grab it and get the heck out of there." One of the first raids had been a total mess. An old-fashioned window came down like a guillotine and speared Richard's hand with jagged glass. We'd barely dragged him under a nearby car when the cops came. I could still see them there in my mind's eye, holding pistols and searching around with flashlights blazing while we lay under the car, scared shitless, trying to stop the torrent of blood from Richard's hand. After that, though, we'd conducted a string of successful break-ins. We'd read about ourselves as the mysterious Santa Monica boy burglars and have big laughs. We were very proud of ourselves. Our undoing had been knocking off the hardware store. We'd gotten away with a couple of hundred jackknives, one of which was unknowingly sold to a cop's son, and the next thing we knew, we were in Santa Monica's brand spanking new jail. It was one of the scariest moments of my life. We were all put into separate cells. Everyone was crying and looking at me because I was the leader. I told them not to say anything. The only evidence the police had were a couple of knives. Sidney Dworkin was the first to crack. He told them about our bus and all our loot. Then they found the bus, and I was the fall guy. As the parade swung by Robert's Market, I thought how different it all might have been had Bob Ross not gone off to war. His family owned Robert's Market when I'd started working there at the age of 8. First, I just hung around and helped Bob close up at the end of the day. Eventually, he started to pay me, out of his own pocket, first a quarter a day, then a quarter an hour, and I worked for him whenever I could. Bob was a real father. He was the one person who took a genuine interest in me as a kid. But then the Japs bombed Pearl Harbor, and he went into the Air Corps to be a fighter pilot. So there had gone my father figure. Still, Bob had written me pretty often. He told me about flight school and the Army Air Corps life. I used to tell people the reason I didn't have a father around, a point of great embarrassment to me, was that he was a Marine fighting on Guadalcanal. All the kids at school believed me. So it worked out well, and I felt a little important, and in my head it kind of made up for losing Bob to the war effort. But without his strong man's influence around, I'd gone on my merry delinquent way. I was already at Mrs. Ordway's when, in 1944, Bob Ross was killed in action. Maybe it was the news of that that made me upset enough to stomp that bully and run away. I don't know. But Bob Ross's death was yet another big signal for David Hackworth to go marching off to war. So I'd marched off to war, and now I'd returned to what I'd always dreamed of, a hero's welcome, a hometown parade. And for a moment, it was just all the pomp and none of the pain of being a soldier boy. Jimmy Miyamura's family lived in a tiny apartment in the Japanese section of Los Angeles. His sister opened the door to the very neat third-floor walk-up and led me into the pale-green living room where Jimmy's parents were waiting. Above the mantelpiece were hung two small crossed American flags. Below them was a basic training photo of Jimmy, young, innocent, grinning. Below the photo, Jimmy's medals from Easy, it could take up to a year for his Raider Award to be approved if it was, Silver Stars, Bronze Stars, and Purple Hearts all hung up in a neat line. On the mantle itself rested the American flag that had draped his coffin, neatly folded in a tight triangle as per regulations. It was a little shrine to a fallen son. Jimmy's parents spoke no English. His sister translated for us, and somehow it all came out in the present tense. He is such a fine boy, such an honorable son. He loves you all like you are part of his family. They told me how they'd waited on the station platform for the train to arrive and how proud they were when Jimmy came out. Shit, he's not dead, I thought, and no matter how hard I tried to flash back to the hospital and to that cold night when we went back to talk to the doc, I couldn't shake the feeling that at any second now Jimmy would be tearing through that front door with a huge grin on his face, that he'd sit down and join us for tea. Then his sister started talking about when they put him in the ground, and in a rush, I was brought back to my senses. Tears streamed down my cheeks, my eyes burned, and my heart broke. After all this time, reality had finally struck home. Jimmy was dead. His father said, "Do not be sad. Rejoice, he dies defending this great country of ours. We are proud our son dies in this country's name." I told them what a wonderful boy Jimmy was and how we all loved him. Then I gave them the last picture I had of him, which was my unmarked copy of the Raider group photograph with all the guys in their gear. As we said goodbye, the father took my hand and held it for a long time. Then he bowed and wished me a happy life. I called Bill Smith's family from a phone booth in Mobile, Alabama on my way through to Fort Benning. Bill's father's English was easy to understand, and his message short and sweet. "I don't want to see you, you murdering son of a bitch. You killed my son for the sake of a bunch of yellow-assed gooks. Don't come around here unless you want trouble." I was dumbstruck. Was this how most Americans viewed the war? In my mind's eye, I saw the Miyamuras, shy, humble Japanese who had come to America and had not yet taken for granted our wonderful land of opportunity and freedom, who had not become callous when, just 10 years before, Their new country had locked their people up as security risks simply because they were of Japanese descent, who were not now bitter, though their new homeland had taken their only son. And then to hear Smith's father, a real live, probably seventh-generation nephew of Uncle Sam, who'd for so long taken the American way for granted that he'd forgotten, if he'd ever known, that there was a price of admission sometimes. But why young Bill Smith had had to pay with his life for his family's ticket was something I, at 21, could not begin to explain, just as I could not explain Korea itself to a heartbroken father through a telephone wire. The U.S. Army Infantry School at Fort Benning was like a circus in the spring of 1952, and in the main ring, I thought as I drove through the MP checkpoint at the front gate and on to post headquarters to sign in, on one side of the road, men from the parachute school were descending from 250-foot towers. On the other, students were running, shouting, and sweating down the road in tight formations of 40. Though not immediately within sight, I knew that somewhere on the huge, ever-expanding base, men were getting training in Ranger, Pathfinder, and other specialty skills, and that somewhere else the Officer Candidate School was pumping out platoon leaders at a furious rate. There was a great sense of urgency at this mecca of all things infantry, and I had a sense of relief. At least there was one place in America that fully understood we were engaged in a war. As for the rest of the country I'd just driven through, it seemed strictly business as usual, and very unfamiliar to me. Since 1945, I'd been stateside for a total of maybe 3 months. My memories were of the war years, the lean years when no one was unaffected by events transpiring across the seas. My 4-year stint in dark, war-torn occupation Italy had me miss out on the post-war boom at home. Now, seeing only the results, I saw a country without a cause. There was a war going on, yet there was no hardship on the home front. There was no rationing, no making do. Employment was high, prices were low, production lines were going full tilt, not just in the war effort, but to keep up with every man's desire for a second car in his garage. Happy days were certainly here again. It was as if Korea, that distant battlefield, did not exist at all, or that killed, missing, or wounded in action were words reserved for someone else's son. To date, more than 105,000 someone else's sons. I was the first student of the 121st Student Officers course to report in. My orders had been fouled up somewhere along the line and classes didn't start for a week. I spent the first couple of days bumming around at the post while future unfamiliar classmates trickled in. On the third day, I was walking out of the barracks when I saw, lugging a duffel bag up the steps, my hero, my mentor, and my friend, 1 Second Lieutenant Steve Prezenka. I don't think anything in the world could have made me happier at that moment. "Combat!" he bellowed, dropping his gear and wrapping me in a huge Czechoslovakian bear hug. Gasping, I told him that Combat was now a first lieutenant, and though I made it a rule not to speak to Second Balloons, since he'd been instrumental in my development, I would make an exception. With Slavic straightforwardness, he told me where to go, and that rank among lieutenants was like virtue among whores. Of course, he was right. We spent the rest of the week reminiscing. I'd stayed in touch with Captain Eggleston and the I&R guys throughout my time in Korea. In fact, I'd used Trust as my permanent address, like Boys Town. When I'd been commissioned, an article had appeared about it in the Trust paper, and apparently Steve, before he got his direct commission, had borne the brunt of my success. "They harassed the shit out of me, Hack. Just wait till you get back to the States. You're going to see Hackworth, and he's going to be a goddamn lieutenant, and you'll only be a master sergeant," they said. So what happens? I come back, and who's the first goddamn guy I see? Hackworth. First Lieutenant Hackworth. Steve laughed. "But I'm proud of you, Combat. I really am." More welcome words I could never have hoped to hear. Meanwhile, the class filled up, 243 students in all. There were a few West Point and University ROTC distinguished military graduates, class of 51, but the majority of the students were battlefield promotions from Korea or direct commissions from Europe and stateside. The direct commissions were all infantry platoon sergeants with an average of about 10 years' service. Like Prezenka, most were World War II vets, and many had at least a year's Korean combat under their belts as well. We were one of the first classes back from the present police action, a formidable bunch, with one Medal of Honor, 6 DSCs, and limps, scars, and Purple Hearts attendant to the 100 Silver Stars at least among us. The class formed into platoons, and student leaders were selected based on rank to handle routine administrative details like getting us to class on time. But there were discipline problems from the start. Our CO was an Air Force major who did not know much about much. Just off the battlefield, the wild ground-pounder pros gave him a hard time and eagerly awaited his next mistakes so they could start in on him all over again. It was a tough job for an airplane driver, and all the harder for him, because making him the butt of our jokes was about the only pleasure we got in our earliest days at Benning School for Boys. The place, for us newly returned Korean vets, was an insult and a joke. The company-grade course should have been something on the order of an obedience school for feral animals. Our class already had enough talent and combat knowledge to cadre a division and within 6 weeks make it the strongest, fightin'est unit in the U.S. Army. What we needed was instruction on being an officer in a peacetime role. Things like protocol, administration, report writing, and which fork to use. We didn't get it. Instead, we were treated to 16 hours instruction on the M1, 16 hours on the BAR, 24 hours on the LMG, and so on. All taught by fresh-faced lieutenant combats whom the class's collective fruit salad, awards and decoration ribbons, would have had shitting for a year. It was ridiculous, like sitting Ernest Hemingway down and teaching him the alphabet. So it was little wonder the old pros who had packed these weapons across Europe, the Pacific, and Korea became resentful, then openly hostile. No wonder we all started looking toward the other side of the fence. The grass over there probably wasn't much greener, but it sure was a hell of a lot more fun. A trooper passing through Benning never had to worry about being alone. There was no shortage of women in Columbus, Georgia, the parasite city living off the booming army post. But if he didn't watch his ass, even the most hardcore bachelor could leave the infantry school with not just a gold bar, but a gold ring. Since George Catlett Marshall had taken a Columbus resident as a bride many years before, it seemed that the major cottage industry here was the entrapment of freshly appointed young officers by the fair city's southern belles. Geographical bachelors, the ones who took off their wedding bands and stashed them upon signing in on post, then carefully tanning the telltale white flesh on their ring fingers until even the most expert scrutiny would not reveal a home fire burning somewhere else, would have had it made, except that the husband hunters were pros at ferreting out the truth. The ladies knew well how the system worked, and the place was so incestuous that there was always a friend or cousin who knew someone or who could get the information themselves. But there were also plenty of fast available types who couldn't have cared less about your marital status. There were the ones who'd ring the BOQ at the start of a new class, introduce themselves, and let you know, sight unseen, they were willing to be your girl until graduation. If you clicked on the phone, this type would pick you up within minutes for inspection or a quick roll in the back of her car. If it didn't work out, there was always another on the phone the following day. The temporary girl of your dreams could also be found in the dilapidated honky-tonks on the strip just beyond the main gate. Generally, these were war brides from Germany, Japan, and Italy, who upon arriving in the States had dropped their husbands to continue their camp-following ways. A GI overseas in the post-World War II days seldom met a nice girl. Most were whores and bar girls who knew how to manipulate lonely and often not streetwise kids. So he'd fall in love, they'd get married, and the blushing bride got her coveted passport back to the land of the round doorknob. Not so brazen or daring as the others, but right near post was yet another class of woman. This was the lonely army wife, whose husband was on an unaccompanied tour. These were temporary widows looking for company. If the magic was there, you had an odds-on first-night score and guaranteed good meals and high times for the rest of your Benning experience with no strings attached. The fact of the matter was, if you were looking for pussy, you couldn't miss, because even if you couldn't find what you wanted in Columbus, all you had to do was put on your steel pot and drive across the Chattahoochee River to Phoenix City, Alabama. This modern-day Sodom made Columbus look like a proper Bible-bashing town. The press called it Sin City. A movie made in the 50s about attempts to clean it up helped Governor Patterson make his name. Anything went there. Gambling dens, red light districts, crooked cops, murder, and intrigue. You name it, Phoenix City had it. A visit there was excellent pre-combat training for Korea. And for us returning guys, it served as the perfect way station between the battlefield and what civilians were telling us was the real world. So we took full advantage of it. And for the first few weeks of class, every morning at least one or two dozen students were missing. Of those who did show, about half turned out in dress uniforms, the other half in fatigues. Some were still in khaki and reeking of booze from the night before. It was conduct unbecoming an officer en masse. Our USAF class leader, backed up by the permanent party CO, took strong and forceful action. Enough horrible examples were made of guys kicked out of the course for disciplinary reasons that finally we settled down. The Mustangs broken and saddled and dutifully trotting off to class. But then it was the old story of leading a horse to water. Instructor, what's the muzzle velocity of the M1 rifle? Most of the old pros would be asleep. Eager Beaver, waving his hand frantically, jumping up from his chair. 2,805 feet per second. Those of us awake and writing letters would make a neat stroke in our notebooks. We called them spring butts, those eager beavers whose impressive memories had them enthusiastically bouncing out of their chairs and up the road to being first in the class. Instructor, what is the weight of a Model 1922 BAR? Eager Beaver, springing to his feet. 19.2 pounds. Now the guys reading From Here to Eternity or Esquire behind their training literature would look up with interest as the letter writers made another stroke in their notebooks. Instructor, what is the chamber pressure of the M1 rifle? Eager Beaver, 50,000 pounds per square inch. With a sigh, Eager Beaver's latest effort would be added to the tally. In 1927, as the infantry school's assistant commandant in charge of the academic department, George Catlett Marshall had tasked himself with ridding Benning of the bunk, complications, and ponderosities. It was hard to believe, but it seemed that all that great general's work had been lost in just 25 years. By the time Eager Beaver answered his fourth question, a great sense of anticipation would fill the room. Will he do it? Can he? We'd sit on the edge of our seats. Guys would jab sleeping students sitting close by to rouse them from their slumber before the big moment. It was time for question number 5. Instructor, what is the cyclic rate of fire for the M2 carbine? Eager Beaver, 750 to 755 rounds per minute. Bingo! We would all shout in unison. Sleeping, writing letters, reading, and keeping score on spring butts alleviated the boredom and killed a little time. But every week the class got smaller. Suddenly another friend would be missing, expelled for flunking too many exams, or for disciplinary reasons like trouble with the law, whores, or not getting to class at all. The failures slipped away, rarely to be seen again on post. A failure at Benning essentially meant the end of your career. What's more, it was mighty embarrassing suddenly to be found wanting in the very thing you've done brilliantly for a decade or so. I kept passing, not because I studied or even cared, but because of trust. We were walking encyclopedias then. A good PFC in that command probably had more military knowledge than a captain in a stateside unit. So for me, Benning was more like a refresher course in, "You're in the Army now." In Trieste, there'd been a position in the 2nd Battalion known as Colonel's Orderly. It was just an honorary thing. The trooper who got it was the one who displayed the best military bearing and knowledge during the inspection of the guard. "Who is the President of the United States?" the inspecting officer would demand. "The President of the United States is Harry S. Truman, sir." "Who is the Secretary of the Army?" "The Secretary of the Army is Kenneth Johnson, sir." Right down the chain of command, you had to have it to the letter. "What is the weight of your weapon?" "Sir, the weight of my weapon is 9.5 pounds. "What is the first general order?" "Sir, the first general order is to take charge of this post and all government property in view." Colonel's orderly was a plum position, though it only lasted for the day, during which you sat in the office of Colonel Two Guns Lyons, so named for the pair of pearl-handled revolvers he always wore, answered his phone, went around with him on inspections, and generally picked up anything you were willing to learn. Even better than the day itself was the pass you'd get for the next three. I never liked guard much, but I loved that three-day pass, so standing tall and looking good, I made a point of making Colonel's orderly 16 times in a row. Funny how priorities change. PFC Combat Hackworth would have been the Benning School for Boys spring butt of them all. The classes droned on. Our instructor in first aid was a young Medical Service Corps MSC lieutenant, full of enthusiasm and seemingly sympathetic to our deep-seated resentment. "All right," he began. "All of you may have noticed that instructors flag probable test questions. Some make it obvious by raising their voices and repeating the information. Some say, 'Listen up, you might see this again.' In my case, what I'm going to do when it's something important is to stamp my foot three times." "Stamp, stamp, stamp," he demonstrated. "So whenever I stamp, you'll know you're going to see it again." He then continued. "Cobwebs have a coagulative property." "Stamp, stamp, stamp." "So a good way to stop bleeding if you're in a difficult situation on the battlefield and a medic's not around is to get a big handful of cobwebs and place them over the wound." "Stamp, stamp, stamp." This young MSC lieutenant really was concerned about how to keep wounded men alive on the battlefield, even though he'd never seen a wounded soldier or the battlefield himself. And the cobweb cure was a sensational bit of information. We all wrote it down for the test. The only problem was I had never, in almost 15 months of combat, seen a cobweb on the battlefield in Korea. I hadn't even seen a spider. The school solutions we were being taught simply didn't work. They had absolutely no legitimate basis given the realities of the present conflict. We'd started from square one with basics and tactics. Now we were moving on through squad, platoon, company, and battalion-sized operations. Some of the company and battalion stuff was related to Korea 1950-51, but most of the instruction was World War II revisited, with weapons, tactics, and mindsets right out of 1945. As the course went on, the instructors sought to introduce the subtler aspects of infantry in combat too, but they were subtleties for the wrong war at the wrong time and with, most definitely, the wrong students. One afternoon, a shiny staff car pulled into our training area. A lieutenant aide-de-camp jumped out, and he was looking for me. "General Malloy wants to see you," he intoned. I didn't know what to think. I'd only met the general, who was Benning's assistant commandant, once, a few days before, at an awards ceremony. I was suddenly scared. The feeling was even worse than having to go to juvenile court to face the judge when I was a little kid. At least then I'd known what I'd done wrong. And I immediately began ticking over my latest transgressions in my head. Brigadier General Guy S. Malloy II was a slender old combat soldier who'd recently commanded an infantry regiment in Korea. The word among classmates who'd served in his command was that he was both a brave warrior and a good man. When I walked into his office, I immediately felt at home with him, and his friendly smile dispelled any fears I had of getting my ass chewed. But the general did come right to the point. He told me he'd been looking over my records, and, based mainly upon my combat performance in Korea, he'd concluded that I had the qualifications to attend West Point. I was speechless. To me, it was like Jesse Owens telling a one-legged sprinter he could join the Olympic team. Maybe Malloy didn't know the only reason I had a high school diploma at all was a lot of luck on the general equivalency diploma GED test I'd taken in Italy. On the other hand, maybe he did, because he outlined a plan that entailed my attending West Point Prep School first, where I'd be tutored in math and other areas where I was academically deficient. He didn't know, I'm sure, that that meant every area. I needed time to think it over. He said I could take all the time I wanted, and then turned the conversation to the officer's course. Never one to miss an opportunity like that, I told him exactly how so many of my friends and I viewed it. General Malloy seemed well aware of the curriculum's shortcomings from the point of view of the returning Korea vets, and said he was working toward making it more relevant. Unfortunately, he went on, there was a lot of red tape to wade through, which didn't make for quick changes. Hell, I thought, if I were wearing that star, I'd kick ass and take names and have this place turned upside down in a week. I didn't know then how the Army's educational system had been poured in concrete, and that only a bunch of satchel charges under the desks of a lot of higher HQ bureaucrats would even stand a chance of shaking it up. None of my friends thought I should go to West Point, and it wasn't just the Mustangs. It was even the guys who wore the big rings themselves, particularly those guys, many of whom were still smarting over the cheating scandal that had rocked West Point in 1951. 90 students had been expelled in the incident, tarnishing the reputation of both the academy and its students. The investigation had not been completed by the time the 51 class graduated, and though, as it turned out, none of that class was implicated, its members now at Benning felt the academy had done them a great injustice by not clearing their names before they were commissioned. As for my own attendance, both West Pointers and Mustangs alike said that if I made it, a long shot at best, 5 years from now I might be able to explain the dark secrets of calculus, but I'd also be a second lieutenant again, and in terms of the skills needed to perform as a proficient combat leader on the battlefield, I'd have gained nothing at all. Their arguments were sound. I took them a step further by thinking that if I'd not been offered this opportunity, I'd never have given West Point a minute's thought. I had no desire to take refuge in well-protected ivory towers. I was not particularly interested in becoming a well-groomed gentleman officer at what I perceived to be the expense of being a capable combat leader. But my brain kept coming back to my favorite U.S. Army soldier of them all, Jim Gavin. Gavin had joined the Army underage, as I had. He'd served in the ranks in Panama, learning his trade hands-on, as I did in Italy. Then he'd entered West Point, as I might, through the prep school. Now he was a 3-star general, CG 8th Corps Germany, and most insiders believed he would one day be chief of staff. Gavin had been one of my great heroes since I was a little kid. During the first years of World War II, he commanded a battalion and then a regiment of paratroopers, all fresh from the Army's first jump school, which he'd helped establish at Benning in 1941. And in 1944, even after he became CG 82nd Airborne Division, the youngest major general in the U.S. Army and one of the youngest in its history, 37-year-old Slim Jim still packed an M1 and lived on the front line with his men. Gavin was the kind of soldier I'd always wanted to be, and he went to West Point. So, despite all the reasons I could think of for not going, in the end, Slim Jim's example left me with little choice. I submitted my application to a very pleased General Malloy. Hello, duty, honor, country. That settled, I had to get my 7-year-old fraudulent enlistment papers and date of birth straightened out. What with all the cheating and cribbing trouble at West Point of late, I didn't think it would be too good if I entered on a lie. Eugene Ernst, a classmate, was an AG officer doing a 2-year regular Army RA detail in the infantry. He'd just graduated from the University of Pennsylvania, knew how the system worked, and he said he'd fix it. He wrote a letter to DA simply stating that a review of my records indicated that my date of birth was incorrect. We enclosed a copy of my birth certificate, and a few weeks later DA responded with a letter stating that my records had been corrected and thanking me for bringing this oversight to their attention. The course plodded on, the attendant bitching and moaning from all of us becoming almost as boring as the instruction itself. Our Air Force company commander had shaped up well. He'd gained our respect, for a man in blue he turned out to be a pretty good ground pounder, so we couldn't even have fun at his expense anymore. We kept ourselves amused in much the same way as the temporarily widowed army wives, sometimes with the temporarily widowed army wives, who spent their days watching soap operas, the latest rage. Far more interesting, though, were the soap operas among my spirited and daring classmates, scenarios that were well beyond fledgling television programmers' wildest dreams. One of the best was the story of the lieutenant, a Korean battlefield commission, who got caught in the rack with the wife of one of the U.S. Army's top pistol marksmen. Sergeant Deadeye had returned earlier than expected from an out-of-state tour with the marksmanship detachment. For the rest of the course, the lieutenant had to use every bit of evasion training Benning could impart to escape old Deadeye's systematic terrorization, which began when the cuckolded husband sank 8 rounds into the back of the guy's brand-new fire-engine red Kaiser as the poor lieutenant attempted to make a quick getaway from the scene of the crime. As for me, I shared many nights of war stories over dinner and drinks with other wolfhounds stationed at Benning, among them Del Evans, who was on the leadership committee with Lou Millette. For a career NCO or officer, an assignment at Benning, preferably as an instructor, was an essential station of the cross. And dear old Barney K. Neal, who was a tactical officer at OCS. But I hardly recognized my romping, stomping wartime buddies. In the peacetime setting, they were proper fathers and husbands. Little children scampered around. Efficient army wives served drinks and smiled benignly as they passed around hors d'oeuvres. The evenings I spent with these old friends were among the best I had at Benning, but all the domestic stuff left me cold. I couldn't believe that these animals I had known on the front line were now being led around by a short leash. I didn't understand how they could do it. The thing was, if you were going to be a good soldier, you had to give in to the Army's demands for all your time, devotion, and energy. But the Army wife and family seemed to demand the same. For myself, at 21, I took comfort in the old, old saying, if the Army had wanted you to have a wife, you'd have been issued one. The nicest surprise at Benning was a wonderful reunion with Jimmy Sparks, my dearest friend from the Trieste days, now a sergeant first class. Jimmy was in the school troop's tank unit. He'd heard I was at Benning, and I came home from training one afternoon to find him waiting for me at the barracks. He was the same old Jimmy I'd left 2 years before, the same wire-rimmed glasses hiding short-sighted eyes, the same build, tall and strong like an Indiana oak tree in the state from which he hailed. We'd been wild teenagers, Sparks and I. We'd both enlisted at 15. We'd gone through basic together, though we hadn't met until we were on the troop ship to Italy, and had been friends from the very first day. We'd raced tanks down hills, chased big-time operators, BTOs, who tried to screw us in our small-time forays into the black market, fought in the Trust 15th Tank Company smokers, and together gave up soldiering for about 4 months to be jocks on the regimental boxing team. We'd drunk ourselves blind and screwed ourselves silly, and spent as much time imagining what we'd do when we were NCOs as we did discussing the finer points of our little Italian girlfriends, Dolores and Laura Donna. Jimmy was married now to a girl named Barbara, who was as small as he was tall, and in honor of our reunion, she gave him leave to go out on the town with me. We had a wonderful time, though totally unlike an evening with Del and Barney Kay. Instead of war stories, there were reminiscences of a youth so recent and yet so long past. Jimmy said he was proud to see I'd become such a good soldier, but that he was a little surprised. Since I'd spent a lot of time in the early days in Trieste puffing my chest out and talking about Muscle Beach, California, he'd kind of thought I'd end up as a beach bum. I told him I was surprised we hadn't both ended up dead, particularly after our adventure on leave in Lido, when we'd tried to stop a fight between 3 Italian guys and a Trust tank sergeant named Medina. During the brawl, one of the Italians had knocked Jimmy down and tried to gouge his eyes out. I'd then hit the guy with the body block with little noticeable effect. Only when a shot rang out did the eye gouger go limp. Medina had intervened with his Beretta. That might have been the end of it, except that the sergeant, who was a fiery, hot-blooded Mexican, turned to the other guys who'd been hassling him and at very close range shot each of them in the heart, dead. Medina was out of his head. Then he opened fire on the crowd that had gathered around throughout the drama and kept shooting until he'd emptied the pistol. I couldn't believe it. "Let's move," I said. Jimmy and I decided to split up and we'd meet at the Wagner, our Venice hotel. I ran down to the ferry, but at 0300 it had stopped running hours before. It was a long swim to Venice, but a good Santa Monica beach bum on the run couldn't be afraid of that, so I jumped in and swam across. There was no sign of Sparks when I got back to the hotel. I washed my gear while I waited for him, put on fresh khakis, and when he still hadn't shown, I made tracks for the cabaret. Jimmy wasn't there either, but the Venezia Giulia police were prowling around all over the place. One little Italian officer noticed I was wearing the same tanker insignia as Medina. Did I know him? Had I talked to him? No, I hadn't even been to Lido that night. They chained me up and dragged me down to the police station, where I found Jimmy. He'd run into Medina during the Great Escape, and they'd both been hauled in together. At least a dozen other GIs had been brought in as well. It seemed to me the whole thing had gotten out of hand, so I got smart with the officer, and he slapped me. Then, when two of his men grabbed me from behind, I kicked the officer in the balls. Unfortunately, he recovered and belted me in the mouth while his goons held my arms. At this point, Jimmy and I, and the rest of the totally innocent troopers, were thrown into a cell, where we were interrogated for almost a week. Medina was found not guilty of premeditated murder. He got the maximum sentence under Italian law, though, 24 years for the killings, but because it was a holy year, the Pope immediately took 8 of them off. Meanwhile, the regiment chipped into the Medina Fund every month to give money to the families of the dead. This knocked another 8 years off the sentence, and in the end, the sergeant would pull only about 6. When it was established that Jimmy and I were just witnesses, we got off scot-free. Or so I thought when we laughed about it in Columbus, Georgia, 4 years after the fact. It wouldn't be for another 7 that I'd be sorry I'd ever met Ernest Medina. During the course of the evening,